After graduating from Boston University in computer science, our guest worked as a software engineer and architect. He is the founder of numerous companies. Among others, he was co-founder and CEO and later executive chairman of Evernote from 2007 to 2016. Since 2017, he has been co-founder and CEO of the AI studio All Turtles. And since 2020, also of, let me spell that correctly, a software company that is involved in the booming market for video conferencing. A few weeks ago, he was guest at DLD in Munich and spoke with Ina Fried on the topic, the state of truth and trust at work. We are incredibly grateful and proud that he takes time for us.
For more than 5.5 years, we have been looking at how work strengthens people instead of weakening them. And more than 350 conversations, we've talked to over 400 people about what has changed for them and what needs to change further. We are quite sure that this is important right now, because the idea of new work, as we say in German, was developed during a real crisis. We discuss with our guests why it is important to develop new things, especially in difficult economic times. We will talk about truth and trust in the workplace and what role machine learning and artificial intelligence will play in the future of work. We're looking for methods, role models, experiences, tools and ideas that bring us closer to the core of new work. In addition, from the very beginning, we have been concerned with the question of whether all people can really find and live what they really, really want in their innermost being. You are at On the Way to New Work today with Phil Libben.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, where do we actually find you today? Where are you?
I am at home in Arkansas, Bentonville, Arkansas. Where I moved after being in San Francisco for about 15 years.
And what we can see in the picture of our Riverside software in the back is not a photo. It's the real background.
No, sadly, it's not. Although it's actually going to look a lot like this in a few hours. We're supposed to get quite a lot of snow today, so it'll be similar.
It's close to it, okay. Yeah, but it's like from the distance here, I have agree to Michael. It looks really
perfect.
Good.
Yeah, it looks totally realistic.
So, Phil, we always start with a very, very simple question that we need to ask everyone in the beginning, and we're curious about your answer here. How did you become the person that you are today?
I mean, I think we all become the person that we are today in the same way, you know, through a whole bunch of random occurrences. I'm not sure that there's much more to it than that. I think humans are good at making narratives, right? So we can look backwards and construct an interesting hero's journey in our own mind that pleases us. But ultimately, you know, everyone's here for the same reason, right? We were born and we walk around the planet for a while and we try to make sense of it. And here we are.
Give us some of
some
these.
Of the stories.
Yeah, I love it.
Can do it the other way around. I mean, I've read an article about a PhD in the US who created some kind of fuck up CV. So he really just wrote down all his failures to give others who are at university the feeling, okay, you have to fail to be successful as a scientist. You have to write lots of articles. Some of them are okay, some of them are good, and maybe one is very good. So if you like to share a couple of stories, bad and good, who can explain?
The hero points that you would define as hero points or formative moments, I would be so curious to get some of them.
Well, I was born in what used to be the Soviet Union, in a city that was called Leningrad. It's now St. Petersburg. My parents, my family is Ukrainian. They're from Ukraine, but my parents were in. They were both professional musicians, and they were in Leningrad at the time, teaching and studying. And we moved as refugees. We were very lucky. So when I was 7 years old, we were able to escape to America, to the U.S. That was in 1979, when it was kind of right before, I think, the Olympics were supposed to be in Moscow. And so they let out a few people to pretend to be a, you know, to show that they were an open country. So we were fortunate. We got out. So I grew up mostly in the U.S., but we lived in, some pretty poor neighborhoods. We never had a lot of money. And so I mostly just stayed inside, and we were kind of got my parents to scrape together enough money to buy an early Atari computer. And I, you know, sat in my room and hacked around on the computer since a pretty early age. And, didn't really, I think, go outside much until, well, any day now. It's been pretty much my life since age seven. I sit inside on my computer and I try to get stuff done. And only recently, I think, when I moved here to Arkansas, to Bentonville, I had a big realization that in the past, I think I always thought about life and work as being kind of in opposition to each other, kind of being, you have to find a balance. You know, I always thought that work was very important, and I didn't really care that much about other aspects. And I think it's only been recently, it's only been a couple of years since I figured out that that actually feels wrong, that there is no work-life balance. You know, there's only life. Work is an important part of it for some people, for me, and I should stop thinking about it as something that's in opposition. And so I've started to enjoy myself a little bit more and go outside and have a more, let's say, human experience of living.
And the reason to leave San Francisco, what was this?
Well, I mean, it just got pretty bad. It became a pretty high stress place. I grew up in New York. I went to Boston for college, and I started a couple of companies in Boston with some college friends of mine. And we were fortunate; we were able to sell those companies. And then when we were thinking about what we wanted to do next for our third company, we decided we wanted to make something that helps make us smarter. The first two companies, we followed the traditional advice of business of always thinking about our customers. So we made We made products for other people, for other types of companies. And we just got bored of that. I got very, very tired of waking up every morning and asking, what does the customer want? Kind of said, I don't care what the customer wants. I want to spend a few years asking, what do we want? What would it be like to build a product for us? Where we were the main customer. And so that's where Evernote came from. So we moved from Boston to San Francisco. Met up with this other team that had a company that also had this idea to give you a cognitive prosthesis, a second brain to make people smarter. We kind of merged our two little startups, became Evernote, I was there was in San Francisco for 15 years. I ran Evernote for 9 years, and then I kind of retired, became a VC, and I never, it's interesting. I never really thought, do I like being in San Francisco? I don't think I think there's some things that I like about it. There's some things that I didn't, but I never asked that question because it didn't matter, because I was always where's the best place for work? And the best place to do a tech startup was in San Francisco. And so that's where it was. And it was only during COVID where all of our companies went fully distributed, where the question even came up. It was work is going to be distributed for me probably forever. And so I can live wherever I want. So maybe I should live somewhere nice. And it was literally the first time I asked that question.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Can you go back to the time between you experimenting with the first Atari at home, staying at home, and then joining the small startup of Evernote and looking onto some of these more or less hero, or even if you say if it's a boring point, but maybe it's still something interesting to take away from that journey?
Yeah, I mean, the first job that I ever had, I worked for this ice cream store. It was a chain of ice cream stores in the East Coast of the U.S. called Carvel Ice Cream. And so that was my first job. I think I was 15 or something, maybe 14. And I was working in this ice cream store, and it was really difficult. And I actually got fired from that job because I didn't have the manual dexterity to operate the soft serve ice cream machine to make ice cream cones because you know, for those of you that are professional ice cream servers, you know that when you, you know, when you're making an ice cream cone, you can't, you don't just like put the cone there and push down, because then you get too much ice cream, because all the ice cream then falls inside the cone. You have to like rotate the cone at a certain angle and speed so that the ice cream goes around the sides and makes a nice cone, but doesn't go inside. I couldn't do that. It was like too complicated. So I actually got fired from Carvel after a few months. And it was a difficult job. And then the second job I got was helping out a law firm in Manhattan with computers. Back then, like computer PCs were new. No one knew anything. And so like I knew as much as anyone else. Like that was back then, it was this magical time when, you know, a 14, 15 year old kid could just be like, yeah, I know the same amount as, you know, an adult about how to wire up a network or whatever. And so I started working with computers, and I realized that it was easier than serving ice cream, because I didn't have to have any like manual dexterity. I didn't have to do anything complicated. I just worked with computers and I was good at it, and it paid like, you know, a lot more. And so I thought, yeah, this is the thing for me. And so I would just always, you know, hack around with computers after that. Started my first, I guess it was kind of a company, but it was in high school. We were assembling PCs. So me and my partner, my friend, we were ordering computer parts from Taiwan, and we were putting them together and driving around to local businesses and selling them. And then I sold that company for $500. So that was my first exit. It was got $500, which was more money than I ever thought possible before. And then started my first real company right out of college, right out of Boston University. That was called Engine 5. And that was in 1997, which was the very height of the first .com bubble. Mm. So all you had to do was like, you can go to any tree in Boston and say .com and shake the tree, and a VC would fall out of money. So that's what we did. And we went from there.
Wow. Okay. I like the approach that you said. You build up companies with this, what you probably learned in the talks to investors. They say, well, have the focus on the customer, and I have a marketing background. That's what they told me. And when I first really dive deep into the story of Steve Jobs, I've read in all articles I've read about him, he always seemed to be to have just him and his core team in mind. What is the product that we like most? Was he a source of inspiration for you, or is it a coincidence that you say we want to build just the product what's good for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think Steve Jobs was a very big inspiration for many of us, kind of at that time. I think that I think. Building for yourself is an interesting thing. It isn't necessarily better than building for other people, than building for customers. But I think it's a lot easier. And it's easier for a very specific reason. It's easier because, you know, let's say it takes you, you know, 10,000 iterations to make a really excellent product. Like you have to iterate. So you have to think about how long does each iteration take. So at my second company, which was called Core Street. It was a security company. We sold big security systems to like governments and militaries and banks. And so when we were selling, you know, security systems to governments, each iteration would take about 18 months because, you know, you have to like develop a system and you deploy it. And then you have like a formal feedback process. And, you know, a year and a half later, you can iterate. And so if you need to do this 10,000 times and it takes you a year and a half each time, then, you know, it's going to take 15,000 years to make a good product. And like, I just don't want to spend 15,000 years, you know, working on something. But in Evernote, we were making it for ourselves, and we could iterate every, you know, 20 minutes, right? Because like, we can judge, as long as we're being honest with ourselves, we can judge whether like a little change made it better or worse. So we can make a change, we can see if it's better or worse, we can iterate, you know. And if you can iterate every, you know, every 20 minutes or every few hours, then you can get through that same 10,000 iterations again, depending on how many hours a day you work. But, you know, you can get through it in a year or 2 years instead of 15,000 years. And so you can make a really good product. So that's really all it is. Like in a practical sense, building for yourself is kind of like cheating. It's kind of like finding a cheat code in a video game. You can just go much faster. But it isn't, I'm very glad that not everyone builds for themselves. Right, there are people that are more worthy of having their problems solved than we are. So of course, you know, like most companies can't be built for the people. The products can't be built for the people building it. Most have to be built for something else. So I think it's very important. It's just that, you know, my general advice is like, if I was giving advice to myself, you know, much younger, I would probably say that, like, make the first company something you do for yourself, not the third one, because I think it's just much easier if you start out building for yourself. And then once you kind of learn things, then you can maybe do better at building for someone else, which is much harder because mm-hmm. you can't iterate as fast, as quickly.
Is like when you go through these stories, it seems like you have a very relaxed, rational approach in attacking the thing, saying like, you know what, this is not how it works. The world is different. How does the feel look like that is really like, holy shit, this is an oh shit moment, magic moment. This is something really exciting that we built here. Is there something, or do you really take it more the way like, you know, let's find it out and see, like, are there different sides, or are there moments when you say like, wow, 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 wow?
I mean, I think it's an interesting question. I mean, there's definitely moments where I felt that, okay, a lot of things are going to change. Like, I had a realization, mm-hmm. and you think, okay, everything's going to be different for going forward, for better and for worse. And they don't happen very quickly. They don't happen very often. By definition, I think mm-hmm. if they were, like, happening very often, then you'd just be wrong about stuff. So, like, I remember in 2007 when I held the first iPhone. So the first iPhone came out. Mm-hmm. I stood in line at the Apple store in Waltham, Massachusetts to buy it. I finally got it and I opened it up and I held it in my hand. And of course I had like every generation of smartphone before that. There's plenty of smartphones before the iPhone. But I remember when I first had the first iPhone in my hand and I actually used it, I remember like understanding, grokking that like, oh, this is going to change everything.
Shit.
Mm-hmm. Now it's different. Like now you have to look at the world. Every time you look at the world, you look at it through eyes that know that an iPhone exists. Mm-hmm. You know, I imagine it would be like similar for when, you know, you know, when humans finally invented fire, like finally like figured out how mm-hmm. to master and control fire, like mm-hmm. it must change the way you think about everything, because like now there's this basic fact in the world where like fire mm-hmm. exists. It is a tool that you can use, you know, the wheel or like levers, money must have been a similar thing, right? Or, like the first time that it really stuck and someone like understood that there's like, I don't have to trade, you know, sheep for apples anymore. I can have this money mm-hmm. thing in the middle. It like changes things. And so there've been a few of those in my life. And those are, I don't know if I would characterize excited about it, but, mm-hmm. but it feels consequential. Mm-hmm. These are these like load bearing mm-hmm. consequential moments. And there's not many of them. You know, COVID was one of them, right? Like when I realized, I don't know, this is probably February or March of 2020 when I really realized what was going to happen. Kind of thought, okay, yeah, this is a consequential moment for the world and everything is going to be different. Like from now on, we're going to have to, every time we think about anything, we have to filter it through the realization that something like COVID exists in the world. So for better and for worse.
I was looking exactly for that, Phil, and hopeful kind of that question. So when you look at the near present stuff that you see right now, I mean, you invested in AI. Your new company is involved in like video conferencing, like working distributed and all that stuff. You started Evernote with the thought of having your like stuff, your mind, your cognition outside. Mm-hmm. If you see things like ChatGPT right now happening, is this a comparable moment where you say, oh, wow, that's a third and a half iteration and this really works well? Or how do you look on these things?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I've been a very big believer in AI for a long time. I mean, since Evernote, we talked about it a lot, and philosophy there, which I think is still the right philosophy, is that you shouldn't think of the A standing for artificial intelligence. It should be augmented. So like real AI, it's augmented intelligence. It makes the human smarter. It's the human plus a computer is much smarter than either could be individually. And that's the real promise of it, is to augment ourselves. And so in the long term, I'm very big believer of this, very big fan. I really think that AI can very positively transform humanity. So yeah, I'm very optimistic in the long term. I think in the short term, I think people are overestimating what these large language models, this new type of algorithms like ChatGPT that are getting so much attention just in the past couple of months. I think people are misunderstanding what they are. And so I'm actually not particularly excited about those. I don't think that this is going to lead us any place particularly interesting. I think the large language models are, I don't know if they're a dead end or if they're just like a pretty long tunnel that you have to pass through, but I think we're still quite a ways away. I think the current systems are fundamentally not on the right track. They're missing some very important things. But I think we're just off by a few years. Like, I don't think this is like a, like, I think if you ask me on a, you know, a 10-year horizon or even a 5-year horizon, I think I'm extremely optimistic about AI. But I think the current excitement is a bit premature. And at the same time, we think the problems that are going to be caused by these things are going to happen right away. They're already happening. And I think they're going to happen this year. So I think things like ChatGPT will make the world a little bit worse or a lot worse before they make it better. But they will eventually make it much better.
My eldest son, he's 26. And when he got in contact the first time, he told my wife and me, "Mom, Dad, for the next generation, this means it's the end of homework." So no one will ever have to do homework for school in the way we know it. So do you think it has an influence of the way we learn, we teach, we do education?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of things, I mean, this happens, right, whenever there's a big shift, right? Things, parts in our society that were already pretty broken and pretty creaky and vulnerable, you know, finally break. So, you know, I think homework and the way that we teach was already under a lot of strain, was already pretty stupid and inefficient. And so every time there's like a big shift, it's going to break more and more, you know, big pieces are going to fall away from it. I think COVID really cracked a lot of education and it did some fundamental damage, but again, because it was already such a troubled piece of our society. And I think, yeah, I think some of these new, the new large language model AIs are going to further chip away at it. I think we're going to find parts, you know, this is the way the world works, right? The parts that are already vulnerable are the ones that get attacked and fall apart and need to be replaced. I'm doing some work with a few colleges, you know, now, and yeah, I think we have to rethink, you know, how do we do, for example, written homework assignments. But those were pretty bad for a long time. So it's not like, I'm not sorry to see those go, but it does force a question right now. I think it's, again, a little bit overstated. I don't think that that written homework assignments have already gone away, but it definitely does put more pressure on it.
Yeah.
Und hier kommt die Werbung. Gleich geht's weiter mit On the Way to New Work. Bleibt dran, unser Werbepartner diese Woche ist niemand Geringeres als Sage. Für Sage durfte ich auch schon mal auf der Bühne stehen. Ein spannendes Unternehmen, solltet ihr euch eh mal anschauen. Aber hier geht's um eine wirklich spannende Studie, die Sage rausgebracht hat, nämlich die HR-Trends, also quasi die Zukunft des Personalwesens, der Personalarbeit, also alles, was man für HR in Zukunft wissen sollte. Und hier geht es um tiefgehende Einblicke in die aktuellen und zukünftigen Herausforderungen eben im HR. Beispielsweise aus der Studie hier mal ein kleiner Fakt, den ich sehr spannend fand. 78% der HR-Führungskräfte glauben, dass der Einsatz von künstlicher Intelligenz bei den HR-Aufgaben in Zukunft viel Zeit einsparen könnte. Oder 79% sind überzeugt davon, dass HR-Prozesse in ihrem Unternehmen stärker automatisiert werden können, um die Effizienz zu steigern. Ich finde es deswegen spannend, weil ich auch schon Anfang des Jahres gesagt habe, das wird das Jahr der Automatisierung und KI ist dazu wichtig. Und wenn ihr da weiter einsteigen wollt in das Thema, dann solltet ihr euch unbedingt die Studie runterladen. Das Ganze findet ihr kostenlos auf Sage, geschrieben S-A-G-E, also www.sage.de/HR, S-A-G-E geschrieben. Und was muss man noch wissen? Sage hat sich zur Aufgabe gemacht, KMUs bei der Bewältigung ihrer HR-spezifischen Herausforderungen durch innovative Softwarelösungen zu unterstützen. Das heißt, diese Lösungen helfen euch dabei, Geschäftsprozesse zu vereinfachen, zu automatisieren, was eben eine viel effizientere und effektive Personalverwaltung ermöglicht. Damit habt ihr dann mehr Zeit für die wirklich wichtigen Themen, anstatt einfach nur Prozesse zu managen. Also, schaut euch das Ganze an. Hier geht es aber erstmal um HR-Trends, die Studie auf www.sage.de/HR. Und jetzt wünsche ich euch viel Spaß mit dem Rest der Folge von On the Way to New Work.
What are the augmented intelligence areas and fields that are you more excited about, or let's say more the rational future view about than the language models, for example?
I think, you know, the weakness of the language models, both their weakness and also why they're going to be quite harmful, is that they're not, you know, they're not reasoning systems. They don't like, they don't reason symbolically from a set of facts or rules. They're just like, they're just auto-completing words. So they just, they don't know what truth is. They don't have a model for truth. They can't be truthful. They can occasionally say something that happens to be true, but they don't know whether it's true or not. There is no, because there is no model of reality. And I think the use cases, like what can you do with the large language models, I think is actually quite limited. I think they're limited to things that please us, that impress us, and the intersection between things that impress us and things where the truth doesn't matter. And so there are a few things like that. There's things around art and inspiration and fiction that I think it could be quite useful as a way to generate like human creativity. Mm-hmm. I think it could be pretty good. I actually am more pessimistic about that even than I was a couple of months ago, because I've been watching my own reaction to some of the AI generated stuff. And it's been interesting just to see how my own reaction to it has changed just in the past, you know, mm-hmm. few months. It's pretty different. Like a few months ago, I was fascinated by the AI, you know, images and portraits and avatars of people. And I was playing, I'd spent many weeks like playing around with it. And now I'm completely bored by it. Like one of the most boring things you can imagine now is like when your friend wants to show you, you know, their AI generated, you know, sci-fi portraits. Like it's just so lame because they all like,
yeah.
Once you kind of know what this is, it's just not interesting at all. Which I'm surprised by, because at first I was very interested, but then as soon as the novelty wore off, I was like, okay, well, this is super boring. So I think what's necessary is a way to actually go back to creating systems that have that are grounded in reality, that understand how to do symbolic reasoning based on, you know, a database, a system of facts, things like that, which is what most of AI research used to be before this like deep learning things led to LLM just a few years ago and sort of gotten most of the attention. But, you know, your car navigation computer, AIs that play chess, like all of that stuff is based on kind of these more fundamental concepts of systems that know how to reason. And so I think it's interesting to, I think we're going to need some sort of a larger truth layer, some sort of a fact layer, some way to ground these AIs into reality as a type of infrastructure, which is extremely important and is going to be being, is, I know several people working on it, and I'm very interested in participating in that. And I think we kind of need that before we can make real advancements in some of the applications that people are excited about. But the applications that people are excited about, I'm also very excited about it. You know, the idea of using this for drug discovery, the idea of using it for, you know, basically everything has become too complex for a human brain to solve, which is a lot of stuff, a lot of things in governance, in policy, in medicine, in finance, are just like, they're too multivariable and complicated right now for a human brain to crack with an aha moment. The augmented intelligence really helps for that. You know, we have this, like, I think we have this model. Let's just take like science. Let's just take health, medicine. We have this model of like the great heroic scientist with a breakthrough mm-hmm. moment. Right? Like penicillin. Mm. It was like some mistake. And then someone's like, aha, yeah. Eureka. Mm. Or like the, you know, the discovery of DNA, you know, the fact that mm-hmm. it was like a double helix was like something that, you know, mm-hmm. came in a dream and someone all of a sudden was like, oh, you know, Eureka, I figured it out. I think those kind of, that breakthrough model for science doesn't really work anymore, because the things that were simple enough that you could, you know, have a breakthrough moment, like those have been figured out for the most part. I'm sure there's still mm-hmm. a couple of things left. But like the diseases that a simple idea could cure have been cured. The diseases that are left are not simple. They're not like single variable or even like 10 variables. There are thousands of variables or millions of variables. They're extremely complex, and they can't lend themselves to a human brain aha. And so we need the augmentation of AI systems that can process far more information to like narrow down the search space to make it the complexity reduced enough so that the human eureka reflex actually can be productive. So it's like the AI can do the work to simplify, to reduce problem spaces so that human creativity could do the final step and actually solve them. And that's going to apply in, again, in medicine and healthcare and policy and all sorts of stuff, which I think is going to be transformative, but not this year, and not ChatGPT. ChatGPT doesn't do that.
As a language model. Yeah.
Yeah. We had a couple of years ago, we had a podcast where we had an entrepreneur who had exactly the same message. She said, "I don't like artificial intelligence as the word for AI. I use augmented." And he had a very simple idea. He said, "Well, you have problems when you have low-profile people sitting in call centers and solving problems for people. They make many mistakes. They are not very empathetic. They do mistakes, and it's frustrating for them. It's frustrating for the supervisors, and it's frustrating for customers. What if I create a machine that analyzes their speech and the speech of the customer, and the AI makes online coaching?" So it says, "Well, you used the word cheap or expensive 3 times in a row. Let the customer speak out, or offer this and this." So the AI helps the call center agent to make his or her job better. And the results he was showing us were astonishing. So this was the first time where I understand, well, maybe this is the way. Not machine or people, it's helping people to do their job better. And I mean, it's maybe a very simple example, but I think it helps me to understand what you mean. Yeah.
But, sorry.
No. I think that's it. There's a deeper thing about that example in particular. There's this book that came out a few years ago that is really good. Let me see if I can find it. Yeah, here it is. It's called Bullshit Jobs. I don't actually know if you guys can see video, but it's by David Graeber. And this is like, it's kind of a funny name, but it's a fairly serious like economic book. And the theory, the bullshit jobs theory, is that there's many, 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 many jobs that are bullshit. They don't do anything. Like people have these jobs. They understand that they're not actually contributing anything to society. They don't actually do anything real. They're sort of like self-referential. And they happen to actually be pretty high paid. These are typically not like, there's very few bullshit jobs that are involved like building things, like actual physical labor, like those tend to be real. But there's a lot of bullshit jobs among knowledge workers where we're just like pushing papers around and doing stuff like that. And this came out before a lot of AI and stuff like that. So it's not about that. But there's a lot of jobs that shouldn't exist. And the AI is not going to replace them or make them better. The AI is going to prove that they shouldn't exist and they're just going to fall away. So no one needs a way for call center text, you know, customer support call center people to be more effective. We need better products that don't require technical support. We shouldn't be thinking of AI as a crutch to make stupid things more palatable. We should be we should be trying to get rid of the stupid things. We should be able to try to make them smarter. But a lot of what people think the applications for AI is going to be is exactly this. It's automating the bullshit jobs, which doesn't need to happen.
It's like with the homework that you explained earlier.
Interesting perspective. Great. Thank you. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Like if you, like, you know, the current AIs do great. Like think about it like this, like, so Star Trek, right, is like super important to me. Always has been. It's like biggest inspirations of my life. It's like Star Trek stuff. And I think you guys know the replicator.
This is absolutely
the generation, right? It makes stuff. So and so the current ChatGPT style things remind me of the replicator. But instead of saying, you know, tea, Earl Grey, hot, and then it like makes a cup of hot Earl Grey tea for you, you go up to it and you say, opinion piece, 500 words, future of cheese dip, and it writes an opinion, a 500-word opinion piece about the future of cheese dip. And the question is in the Star Wars world, that replicator solved material scarcity, right? Like if we had such a device, obviously it would be massively transformative for society because material things would no longer be scarce. So it solves material scarcity. What kind of scarcity does ChatGPT solve? Is there a scarcity for poorly written generic things? Like, do we need a generic 500-word opinion piece on cheese dip or an undergraduate homework assignment about, you know, the real meaning of, I don't know, Huckleberry Finn? Do we need that? Is it, do we need more of it? Do we need to, is there a scarcity of those things that we need to solve? I don't think so. I mean, but this is a fair question. Maybe in some case, mm-hmm. in some senses there are, but it's an interesting way to think about it. Like, yes, we can make it cheaper to make bullshit, but should we? And what's the effect going to be in the world? And I think the positive effects are going to be pretty limited. I think the negative effects are going to be significant, but the positive effects are going to be pretty limited until we get to a completely different branch of technology and AI that's actually not about making things that no one wants. Like, we don't need more of the things that people don't want.
Yeah,
it's a very philosophical base layer that I can 100% agree on. I use it like whenever, for example, the last days I was kind of missing an idea. I use it as a starting point. It's this kind of, I have this sometimes when the page is blank, like starting to paint, making mm-hmm. a video, making stuff like that.
Yeah,
I give it a random, for example, I ask it when I was at the airport, give me an idea for a movie like Hateful Eight from Tarantino, mm-hmm. but it yep. plays in German and describe me the characters. Mm-hmm. And one of the characters it described was quite funny. And I'm like, I continued from that character.
Yeah.
Completely random. So, and it's not random, I know, but still like using it for stuff like that.
Yeah. I think that's a good use case. I think that that's in that Venn diagram intersection. That's what I said. Like, I've started to think of all those as the muse use case. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the thing that inspires humans to be creative. And I think those are really mm-hmm. good use cases. I think there's lots of ways that you can use it to generate things that, you know, you can use it to generate 100 ideas really quickly. And then you just glance at them. And then a few of them will stick into your head that spark creativity. And I think that's good.
Yeah.
But then it's like, it's not being creative. You're being creative.
It's doing
the prompting.
Got it.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
And this is because this augmentation that you explained, this really speaks to me what you're saying. What I was thinking about on the other side, though, was when you said like, okay, it like takes away the stupid jobs. Humans do really stupid things for a really long time. Which is a quite interesting phenomenon. You've been seeing a cracking system that you've been fleeing with your parents, as you explained, and this system mm-hmm. was cracking, and now it doesn't exist. But parts of these systems are still doing pretty stupid things.
It's worse now. If you're just talking about Russia, I think it's worse than it's ever been.
Exactly. Like, I think the Soviet that's what Union I'm talking
was,
about.
It turns out that the Soviet Union was like the bright spot. In Russian history, it's just
we see right now.
Catastrophic,
so,
yeah.
Since you have a philosophical view on that one, on humanity, and since you've been actually also like knowing that it's part of your home country, can you give us your view on that perspective and why people are doing so stupid and crazy things? Like, where are we heading?
Yeah, I mean, I never considered it my home country. It's a country that we had to run away from because it was so hostile to, you know, to people like us. My family is, you know, Jewish Ukrainian. It was not a good place to be. And so, you know, we fled at the earliest opportunity. And you know, I never had any affinity for the place or the culture. It never felt like home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing that felt like home was the U.S. because the U.S. actually welcomed us and took us in. But I think there's this general problem of, I'm thinking about it as our epistemic infrastructure. So, you know, when I was in college, you know, I studied some philosophy and, you know, epistemology was, you know, like the study of how we know things, right? Like, why do we think we know things? How do we think we know mm-hmm. things? And like, it wasn't particularly important or like commercially viable before. But I think in the past few years, it's gotten to be a real problem. I think we have this, like, we have this breaking of our epistemic infrastructure, like our infrastructure as a society of how we know things. You know, whereas we can agree on, you know, we can agree on opinions. We can have the same opinions or we can have totally different opinions. That's fine. But, you know, it used to be like we can have different opinions. We can disagree in opinions, but we at least agreed on facts. But then it became harder to agree on facts because there's so different versions of facts. So we don't have to agree in opinions, and we don't even have to agree in the facts, but we at least agreed on how we find out the facts. We agree that, like, well, okay, if you want to know something, you Google it, or you like look at Wikipedia or something. But now even that's breaking. We're like, we don't agree in opinions, we don't agree on facts, we don't even agree on how we're going to determine the facts. And I think what you're seeing in Russia is like an extreme example of that, where this entire war is based on a completely like insane, you know, understanding like of Ukraine and Ukrainian history and the Russian propaganda that goes about it. I mean, it just makes no sense. And yet you have tens of millions of people that are, you know, listening to this very intentional propaganda. And it like, and it kind of works, right? There's a bunch of people in Russia. Obviously, a lot of people are opposed to it, but a lot of people aren't that opposed to it. And you can kind of see this development of this like anti-facts, this development of misinformation or disinformation or propaganda, or whatever you want to call it, which isn't a uniquely Russian thing, but Putin's regime really seems to be pushing it further, you know, than it's been pushed before in a more extreme case. And it's almost like a warning for the rest of us. Like Russia's greatest gift to the world for the past 800 years, Russia's greatest gift to the world has been the warning. It's like, oh, you think this is pretty bad over here? Like, hold my beer. Let me show you how bad it can really be. Like this is their constant thing that they're doing. And so it's like, we think that we have like a divided society with like social media and misinformation and propaganda in the West. And they're like, hold on, let us demonstrate like the logical extreme of this thing. Mm. And it's pretty scary. And I think this is very much worth, you know, taking seriously. So obviously like the current war in Ukraine is, you know, is monstrous and has to be ended. And it can only be ended by a complete military loss of Russia. But even bigger than that, we have to look at like, how do we get to this complete disconnect, complete breakdown of our epistemic infrastructure, the infrastructure for how we know things in the world? And how do we make sure that doesn't happen anywhere else? How do we make sure that doesn't happen in, you know, other countries? And I think the current large language models, AIs, are like, they're not going to make it better. They're going to make it worse. By letting you generate infinite amounts of very plausible bullshit, they're not making it better.
Hmm. Yeah, this is the
yeah, they're creating alternative facts.
Yeah, that's the connect I was thinking you were making, and you were like opening up a new perspective on that one, because there is a layer underneath that is becoming then very dangerous. Because it all starts with speech and communication and words and stuff you say, like before it turns into something. This is how all the bad stuff started.
There's a quote that I like that I've been misattributing this whole time, because I think I was thinking that like Bertrand Russell said this, but it turns out it didn't. But then the internet still thinks it was Bertrand Russell. It's kind of funny. But the quote is, I don't know who said it, but the quote is, the greatest problem with communication is the illusion that it's happened. And like, yeah, this is true. Like this is, that's the biggest problem. Like the biggest problem of communication is like when you think you've communicated and you haven't, and it's actually not communication, it's something else. And we have this worldwide system where we've kind of calibrated the truth. Like, and we think we know how to deal with it. We think we're like, well, look, we know who to trust and we know who not to trust, kind of. Like, you know, we know that if it comes from RT, it's bullshit and, you know, just ignore it. But if it comes from, you know, the BBC, then maybe we trust it. And, you know, we can kind of look at something and we can determine if it looks fake or if it looks real. And, you know, we have this calibrated system of defenses of like how we think we know the truth. But that system is based, it's like defending a city from a flood. It's like you have these flood barriers, you have these floodgates. Mm-hmm. And the floodgates are meant to protect you from a certain level of water, right? It's like you have a certain level of floodgates, but like the highest water is like over here. And so they like kind of match. So we have these truth floodgates where we think we know how much it costs to generate a plausible lie. Like how much effort or money does it take to say something that's not true, but that's believable, that's like takes some amount of effort. And how much effort does it take to determine whether something is true or not? And you know, and there's like a rough equilibrium of those things, and that's how the world operates. But right now, the cost, because of these AIs, the cost of telling a very convincing lie has just dropped to zero. The cost of detecting the lie hasn't changed at all. And so this equilibrium that we've built over the past few decades doesn't work anymore in 2023. So we're about to get like flooded by this tsunami of bullshit because like it turns out there's like far more water than the floodgates that we have. And this is interesting. And it's, you know, I don't want to overstate it. Like, I don't think this is like a humanity ending catastrophe. I don't think it's like, I think it's going to be bad, but I don't think it's going to be like as bad as, you know, it's not as bad as like COVID, which we all just live through as a society. So like we'll get through it. And on the other side, like long on the other side, there's actually huge benefits because I think, like I said, I think the AIs will be very beneficial in the long term. But the next couple of years are going to be very turbulent and very interesting because there's going to be a lot more lies and a lot more bullshit in every aspect of our lives than we've kind of used to dealing with. And I don't know exactly how it's going to happen. But yeah, you can kind of squint at what's going on in Russia right now as like a early warning, you know, horror story of like, you know, where we don't want to end up.
Werbung. Dein Cloud-Account wurde deaktiviert. Bitte neu anmelden. So oder so ähnlich könnte eine Mail bei dir im Postfach heißen, aber hinter der Webseite, hinter dem Formular steckt kein Tool, sondern ein Phishing-Angriff. Betrüger kommen so an die sensiblen Daten deiner Company und unser Partner SoSafe hilft dir dabei, um das menschliche Sicherheitsrisiko bei Cyberattacken zu minimieren. In den letzten 3 Jahren hat nämlich jedes zweite Unternehmen einen erfolgreichen Cyberangriff erlebt und Firmen investieren zwar Zeit und Ressourcen in Firewall und Technik, aber 85% aller Datenschutzvorfälle sind tatsächlich auf den Faktor Mensch zurückzuführen. Und SoSafe hilft durch verhaltenswissenschaftlich fundierten E-Learning, Gamification, intelligenten Angriffssimulationen, Risikoanalysen und Auswertungen dabei, eine Human Firewall in deinem Unternehmen aufzubauen. Wenn ihr es testen wollt, auf sosafe.de/omr könnt ihr euch kostenlos für eine eigene, individualisierte Phishing-Simulation anmelden. Also einfach mal testen, wie eure Klickrate im Unternehmen wäre auf solche Mails. Bisherige Unternehmen hatten da zum Beispiel 30%. Ihr könnt gucken, ob euer Unternehmen über- oder unterbietet. Alle Infos auf sosafe.de/omr. Werbung Ende.
So when I sum this up, trust and truth are under attack. And you were giving this speech or this interview on DLD in Munich under the topic the state of trust and truth at work. So maybe we jump back to work and you can give us some of your insights you shared in this interview.
Yeah, I mean, I think trust is becoming like the most important issue in several stages of society, including at work. I think, you know, there's a big split happening in many companies. And at first I thought the split was going to be between like in companies that are in office and companies that are remote. I thought that was going to be the division. But actually, I think the real division right now that's really forming very sharply is between high trust and low trust organizations. So there's organizations that many that are fundamentally low trust, that do not trust their employees. And employees do not trust the company. I think many CEOs right now feel that most of their people don't do anything. Like literally, like I talk to a lot of CEOs and many of them feel that like, I don't know if most of my employees actually do any real work. And I think a lot of employees don't trust the company. They feel like they're going to get laid off or company's not being honest with them in some way or not looking out for their interests. And of course, both are right. And, you know, both sides are right and both sides are wrong. But there is this environment of low trust. And from there, you get all sorts of low trust tactics. You get, you know, well, if I can't see you working, how do I know you're being productive? So, you know, it's butts and seats. It's you have to see you physically in an office 3 days a week or whatever. Or it's, you know, companies installing all this spyware on their employees' computer, which is looking at, you know, how often you move the mouse and what your face looks like, all of that kind of stuff. These are like very low trust environments. And I think that's terrible. Like if I was getting started in my career right now, if I was, you know, still a young person, the most important thing for me would be to never get stuck working in a company that didn't trust me. I would never tolerate that. I would never tolerate that among my friends, right? I would never spend time with like friends or family members that were always like, didn't trust me and were always making me prove myself, right? You wouldn't find that acceptable in a personal relationship. Yeah. Why the hell would I find it acceptable in a professional relationship? Mm-hmm. I mean, I spend more time doing work stuff than I do hanging out with my friends and family. So to me, that would be the most important thing. And there are mm-hmm. companies that are trying really hard to say, okay, well, obviously we don't want to be low trust. We want to be high trust, but we want to be also effective. And so how do we make a high trust culture that is actually accomplishes things and gets things done? And that requires, I think, a different way of thinking about things, a different tool set. And we're very much trying to do that. We're trying to make the core products that could be used to create a high trust environment. And we're very much like experimenting on ourselves. We're back to making things for us because we, as a company, companies, really want to figure out how to make a distributed high trust structure that actually works. I think this is I think for us this is the most important work right now.
I've read in an article about you that you changed your perspective on working from home, working from the office over the last years. Maybe you can explain a little bit what is your new perspective? What was your old perspective?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it was, so at Evernote, I banned most video meetings because I thought, you know, it's just a bad experience. So for important meetings, like for board meetings and things like that, they said, you know, no video meetings. Everything has to be in person. And, you know, we spent a lot of money designing a really nice office space, you know, in the Bay Area. And we spent a ton of money busing people into it. You know, we had to bring people in from everywhere on buses and trains and cars. And then we spent a lot of money buying everyone really fancy headphones so they could like wear those headphones to like tune out all the other people that we brought into the office. And all of that was obviously pretty dumb. You know, the average commute was about 2.5 hours a day for most people, you know, often 3 hours or more, depending on traffic. And so that was pretty, you know, pretty inhumane and pretty bad. And I didn't really understand, you know, I thought that, well, if you weren't in the office, you weren't like really working. And I kind of thought this way until COVID. And then, you know, when COVID happened, we all had to go and, you know, work from home. And it was terrible. Working from home sucked. The number of meetings that I had before COVID, I looked at my calendar, I had 9.5 meetings a day on average. And then when COVID started for the first couple of months, it went from 9.5 to 15 because, you know, there's no more commuting. So I could just, what do we know how to do? Mm-hmm. We just know how to have meetings. It was all just like Zoom calls back to back to back. And it was terrible. It was bad. But then we started thinking, well, we can't just wait for things to go back to the way it was because it's never going to go all the way back. And nothing ever goes back. Like at no point in the history of humanity has anyone ever gone back. You can only go forward. Time only goes in one direction. So we kind of said, all right, it's going to be some version of this for a long time. So how do we, instead of just like complaining, how do we move forward? How do we make this better? And that's what got us thinking about how to restructure communications, how to restructure meetings, how to have, you know, high trust. And that's what led to, and now we have, now my meetings went from 9.5 before COVID to 15 during COVID, but now I'm down to about 4.5 a day. So like, this is one of them. I have about on average, I have 4.5 meetings every day and I still don't spend any time commuting and I have far more time to be productive, but I'm also like, I can walk my dog and I can work from museums. And I have like a much better life and much more productivity. And it all kind of came from this idea of, all right, how do we unwind this? And probably the biggest thing was changing how we do meetings and when we do meetings.
Okay. That would have been my question. How did you manage to reduce your meetings by 70%? So what are the clues? So how do you decide whether this is one of the major topics of Christoph? Do we need a meeting? It's one of his beloved questions. So what did you really change to go down?
Well, so there's kind of two main things. So first is high trust. So basically we said, okay, everyone who works here is autonomous, high trust adults, and we never need to have a meeting to check up on you. So we got rid of the idea of a meeting as a control structure, right? We don't need the meeting to make sure you're working. So there's no more stand-ups, there's no more status check-ins in meetings. It just doesn't make any sense in a meeting. Like we have a meeting when we need to, and we sort of we trust you. We don't use the meeting as a control mechanism for not trusting people. And so we just thought, okay, well, how many of our meetings were basically control mechanisms versus actual communication? And it turns out probably half were just unnecessary. So those are just easy to get rid of. But then the main thing was kind of this. We have this idea of this pyramid. As you said, there's like three sections, three types of communication. You can do in person, like live in person, physically in the same room, or you could do live video, or you could do recorded video. And our main insight was that these weren't replacements for each other. They were co-equal partners. And each area was really good for some things and bad for other things. And so you should do each thing in the area that is best for it. So in person, when you're up here, when you're like in the top of the pyramid, you're actually like meeting, you know, in person with people. It's really good for like for strengthening relationships, for, you know, establishing trust, for having experiences. But it's actually really bad for conveying complex information. Like, it's a terrible experience to sit in a classroom at a lecture and like, hey, you have to take notes and you have to worry about missing things and you have to do it at the same speed. Recorded video is actually great at conveying complicated information. Because, you know, you can record yourself, you know, your speaker and slides and backup materials. You can do it until you get it right. You don't have to worry about screwing it up. And then, of course, it's much friendlier for the people watching it because they can watch it when they're most able to pay attention. They don't all have to watch it at the same time. They don't all have to watch it at the same speed. Most of the time, it's actually much better watching things at faster than 1x, especially if you've got backing visuals. You don't have to worry about missing anything. You can rewind it, all that kind of stuff. And then live video, what the three of us are doing right now, right? So your audience is going to be watching this and recorded, but right now we're doing live. Live video is really good for having an interactive discussion, like actually making decisions, you know, pointing to things, but it's not very good for conveying complex information. So what we said is, okay, we're going to do all three, and we're going to figure out the right things to do in all three. So probably 60% or so of our time now we're spending down here in recorded video, any kind of status update, plans, you know, people are just making video plus, you know, background information. We send those around, people watch them, you know, ahead of time. And then once everyone was really on the same page, then we get together live in a live video to discuss and to make decisions. And the test for this is very easy. We call this the face hole test. So the idea is when you have a bunch of people having a conversation, one person is moving their mouth a lot and nobody else is, that's not a conversation. That's a lecture. That should not be happening live. If one person is talking for many minutes and nobody else is, then that should have been recorded. But if everyone is taking turns, asking questions and answers, and you're like, people are, you know, moving around and pointing at things and saying, okay, let's, what if we move this over here and doing that kind of stuff, then it's very good for live meeting. And then we get together in person, but when we're in person, we don't waste time like sitting in a room showing each other slides. That's stupid. When we're in person, we have experiences that bond us, that get us closer together as a team. So we go have dinners, we go for hikes, we walk through museums, we're like doing the things that really help with creativity and with relationships. And so when we kind of said, all right, rather than trying to cram everything into just this in-person stuff, half of it we could just get rid of because it turns out no one needs it. And then the other half we sort of spread out over these three areas. And not only do you like save a lot of time in meetings, but productivity went way up because this is just a better way of doing stuff. So that was the main tickle.
Yeah, great.
We built the product.
You really speak straight from my heart. I cannot even tell you how happy I feel. I wrote messages to Stuart Butterfield to talk into him all the time, into like allowing voice messages and video recording in Slack. Mm-hmm. I always had to hack YouTube, upload it, make it a hidden link and do that. I love it. And we're quite used to the asynchronous way of video and so on. One challenge that I see in particular, it's in Germany quite a challenge, I have to say, you now have the situation that Germans, they always love very complicated things. They love hybrid meetings. So in the case when you then are together, there's always one person or two people missing, especially the larger the corporation, the more hybrid the meetings. Are you very consequent in saying, no, when we're together, we're together? Or do you say, well, it's okay if someone is coming in hybrid?
Yeah, I mean, we try not to have part of high trust, right? This is always how we balance these things out. Part of being very high trust is that we try to have very few hard rules. Because what we're telling people is like, we trust you to figure out what's best. We want you to use your best judgment to figure out what's best. And you're allowed to get it wrong and we have to learn from it and we have to like make adjustments. So we're very hesitant to say like, you must never X, because that's not generally a high trust setting. The only like hard rules are ones where we're talking about ethical issues. So there's, you know, hard rules about like ever lying or being deceptive or anything that would cross an ethical boundary is like pretty hard. But in terms of like policies, no, we sort of trust people to figure it out. So, you know, if there's an in-person gathering and someone can't make it at the last minute or something, okay, well, we understand. So we have to figure out a way. We have to figure out what to deal with it. And sometimes that means, okay, well, maybe you can dial in for a small portion when we're actually doing the critical things to make decisions. You're not going to participate in the team building. And so, okay, you couldn't make it, you couldn't make it. You know, you got to make it next time. Mm-hmm. One of the things is we try to make the in-person gatherings not informationally bearing, right? Because again, we don't use the in-person stuff to share information or to make decisions. Mm-hmm. So if you can't go to the in-person stuff, you're not going to miss the information. You're not going to miss the decisions because that's all done ahead of time on video. The in-person stuff is to have joint experiences and to bond, which is very important. But it's not like if you miss it, you're like behind. You should go to the next one. So they're not hard rules, but for the most part, yeah, we try to make the in-person stuff something that you don't need to be at. If it's not critical. Mm-hmm. So this is actually happening today. So today, as we're talking next door, my finance team is in town. So the finance team, came to visit. Because this is actually their first time, I think, meeting everyone in person, just on the team and, you know, meeting me. And we've got some dinners scheduled and we're walking around and doing, you know, walking and that kind of stuff. And one of the people was supposed to come and couldn't make it at the last minute because there was some issue with travel visa or something, so couldn't make it to that. And he's going to get dialed in for an hour, I think, today and an hour tomorrow, which we have these like very short segments where we actually have to like make some decisions. So that's understood. But he's not going to be dialed in for 6 hours where people are walking around doing stuff because that's not informationally load-bearing anyway. So we try to set it up that way. But in general, you know, this goes back to Evernote. I don't believe that most things that start out, well, you know, in Germany, we X, or, you know, well, in Japan, Japanese people are really into, you know, Y. Mm-hmm. Like in Brazil, it's this. Like anytime, most of the time when someone starts a statement by saying, you know, in my country, it's like this.
Oh, I hate kinda, it so
I
much.
Yeah. I kind of don't believe it. I kind of think that. Yeah.
No. I painted black and white, of course.
In my country or in our industry, I hate this.
No. Yeah. It's what I wanted was your opinion on hybrid, and I got the answer.
Yeah, perfect.
So that's perfect.
Very inspiring. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, definitely.
The issue I have to just point it out for our listeners, we got a live demo of your product now, which was very exciting. So we couldn't do
we
it.
I have the clip.
You have the clip.
Of course. It's not only the podcast, it's also the video. Maybe. Of course, we have to show that because...
It was fascinating. And I think you have two new customers. At least.
Thank you.
And some of our listeners will test it as well. Thank you.
Yeah, it's before we come to one of the last question, a quick question, like if someone listens now to say like, oh, that's interesting, I got to try that tool. Like, what was he like doing in the background? Where should they go? Why should they test it? And for who is it good for?
It's at which is just MMHMM dot app, mm-hmm. but you can just Google for that. Mm-hmm. Surprisingly easy to find. Yeah, see, mm-hmm. anyone can say it.
Yeah.
It's video communication for hybrid teams. So it's for anyone, individuals or teams that work, you know, sometimes remotely, sometimes in person, and want to kind of go back and forth between them. Everyone can download it and try it. But the main thing that it's for is we're saying video, we're all very lucky that Zoom was around when COVID happened. I think like the world would have been much worse if we didn't have something like Zoom. But these like first generation ideas of video, they're not enough. Zoom is great at being able to kind of connect everyone. But what you really need is something a little bit more advanced in terms of what you can do asynchronously and what you can do synchronously. And so we work with Zoom and Microsoft Teams and, you know, WebEx and everything. So you can use this with whatever video system you're currently using, or just by itself. You can actually, you don't need to use it with anything else. And it lets you, when you're talking live, be much more interactive, like I've been doing here. So you can have multiple people on the screen and you can show things and you can move around. And it's just a much more, you're not sitting in a little jail, a little box all by yourself. But you can also make really easy recordings and you can go back and forth between synchronous and asynchronous smoothly. So that is, which I think is one of the keys to maintaining an effective high trust organization.
Yeah.
We definitely need to talk and look more into that, because I think the terms synchronous, asynchronous and video communication, I use it around like all day long. And what I've been seeing, it's I get the hook, I get the idea. And so thanks you for showing, and we will definitely show the clip.
And I the product demo was fascinating. The last part was fascinating, but the rest was fascinating as well. And thank you so much for giving us insights in your life, in your story, in your entrepreneurial story. And maybe we have the chance to visit you at some day in Kansas.
Please.
Do a second life. Then maybe go for dinner, what we can't do here. And we always have one last question at the end. Where will you go next, or what will you achieve in life? Do you have anything like a bucket list or a purpose you're heading, or where to go?
I have a very minor, small one, which I think since you asked, we can do. Which is, I would like to get rid of the phrase bucket list, because I think it's a really weird way to think about things. It's also it's also a suicide reference, which I think most people don't know. But so I don't know why anyone would say that. So as a minor thing, let's just get rid of bucket lists. As
we never ask it.
Yeah. as a bigger point, look, I just want to, I want as many people as possible to have, we kind of think about it as this. We think of it as the OO loop. OO is, you know, out of office. We kind of think about it like this, that for creative people, for people who, you know, we work with our brains, if you improve the quality of your life, you know, you live in a nice place in a good neighborhood, and you have time for family and friends and music and art and good food, it makes you more creative, right? So improving your quality of life improves the quality of work. And if you improve the quality of work, then you get more success, more satisfaction, more money, which you can then invest in improving the quality of life. And so you get this feedback loop, right? You get this cycle of improving quality of life, improves quality of work, improves quality of life, improves quality of work. And this could really make the world better. And what I want is to make this true for as many people as possible. I want them to live in this loop where they can improve their quality of life, which will improve their quality of work, which will improve their quality of life. And I think this is the system that can make the world a lot better right now.
Yeah. A nice. New circle of life. Yeah.
Thank you.
Very nice. Phil, thank you so much.
Very good
thank
pitch.
You.
And enjoy the snow later today.
I will. Yeah. It should be. Hopefully it'll be nice. It's very pretty here when it snows. And you should come if you actually have time. Bentonville, Arkansas is a surprisingly, unexpectedly great place. It's kind of amazing. So
okay.
Look into it and come visit.
We will.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Das war, wo hast du den her? Wie hast du es gemacht? Wieder einmal ein typischer LinkedIn. Michael zaubert auf LinkedIn einfach mal Philippen raus.
Der wurde mir in meine Timeline gespielt und dann habe ich gesagt, wow.
Jetzt schreibe ich mal den Evernote-Gründer an.
What the heck? So. Genau. Und fand den Lebenslauf spannend, habe ein bisschen gegoogelt. Der Name hat mir vorher nichts gesagt. Und aber ich war mega begeistert. Ich hatte ein bisschen auch reingeschaut in sein Video vom DLD und cool. Also richtig klasse und also merkt mal wieder, wie viel Lust ich habe, auch mich mit dem Thema AI zu beschäftigen. Mhm. Also wir sollten dringend unseren deinen guten Freund und meinen mittlerweile guten Bekannten, du weißt, wen ich meine,
Adrian. Mal vielleicht mal sein Co-Founder, Rasmus.
Vielleicht auch das oder technische auch eine Seite. Coole Frau da. Also auf jeden Fall, wir sollten weitere Folgen zum Thema AI machen. Ja. Aber es ist eben auch wahnsinnig spannend, mit jemandem zu sprechen, der dann doch auch sich so viel Gedanken darüber macht, wie Zusammenarbeit geht.
Das also fand ich.
Auch für dieses Jahr ein paar wirkliche Experten.
Ja, auch ein Fundamental Layer, was halt das alles bewirken kann. Also das fand ich geil. Und also hier Props an dich, dass du den einfach angeschrieben hast und rausgezaubert. Das ist ein richtiger Michael Traummann. Ich sitze am Montagmorgen um 8 und schreibe mal irgendwelche Leute an. Ah, der Gründer von Evernote, why not?
Ja, weiter geht's.
Auf geht's, heiter weiter.